We live on the planet of the microbes, but it's largely unexplored. Human beings are 10 parts microbes, 1 part human. If microbes aren't already living on Mars, they will be when the first humans arrive several decades from now. When we step on Mars, we're not going alone. Microbes will go with us. It's time for microbes to have their due. Those are the comments of David Stahl, a microbiologist at the University of Washington in Seattle. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Trillions of microbes can be found in all corners of the Earth, sometimes making life possible and other times destroying it. What are microbes, and why are they important? Are they more than disease-causing germs? Why would a lab here in Wisconsin study caterpillar guts? We'll be posing these and other questions to our guest, Joe Handelsman, professor of bacteriology and plant pathology and chair of the Department of Bacteriology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman.
I would guess that it would be almost hard not to study microbes. Aren't they everywhere?
They are everywhere, and they're also irresistible to biologists because they're such interesting creatures.
Well, let's get a definition. What is a microbe?
A microbe is anything that we can't see with our naked eye that's alive. And so we typically use the word to include bacteria, fungi, little nematodes, those are tiny worms that are too small to see, and viruses.
And how do terms like germs and bugs fit into that?
Bugs are kind of a colloquial definition of microbes. It gets really confusing if you work on insects because then both the bugs and the bugs are bugs. And then germs are a pejorative term used about microbes that only applies to a very tiny minority of the microbes on Earth.
Can you give us some sense of the scope? I mean, trillions of microbes. I mean, we'll keep hearing about, you know, microbes found at the floor of the ocean or in radioactive rock or everywhere. Give us some sense of just what we're talking about.
Well, we don't know the extent of it. That's the biggest part of the answer is that we have not described the full breadth of microbiology because only in the last few years, about 20 years, have we begun to understand the ignorance with which we've been living. Microbiologists used to think that we knew a lot about microbiology, and then we discovered that because most microbes don't grow on our petri plates in the laboratory, they've been essentially invisible to us. And so only recently have we begun to describe that diversity. So we know that there are many, many thousands of species, but we suspect there are probably many millions of species. Just in the human body, there are probably 10 to the 12th cells that are microbial, and we have far fewer than that. As you said earlier, only 10% of the cells in our bodies are our own. The rest are the microbes.
So we're crawling.
We're crawling with microbes, and we better be.
What drew you into the field, and what do you like about it?
Well, I first became a microbiologist because I was interested in the interactions between organisms, and I studied bacteria that take nitrogen gas from the air, which is unusable to us and most other creatures, animals and plants. But there are some bacteria that can take the nitrogen from the air and turn it into ammonia, which is usable by plants. And in fact, that used to be the primary source of nitrogen in biological systems generally, the nitrogen that bacteria so-called fixed. And I was just fascinated by that process. I thought it was incredibly neat that we all depend on this very small group of microorganisms that have this ability. And I had never heard of them before I went to graduate school. I thought that was pretty surprising as well. I think microbiologists find microbes interesting in a general way just because they are so broad in their capacities. There are microbes that can use rocks as their energy source. There are microbes that will degrade essentially any natural substance on Earth. There are microbes that will cycle just about any nutrient on Earth. They're responsible for a lot of the carbon cycle and therefore play a big role in both creating and mitigating global climate change. So there are almost no functions on Earth that are free of microbes or that aren't dependent upon microbes.
How do they fit into the scheme of things when we talk about evolution, both the development of people, and after the development, I suppose they're constantly evolving, but it sounds like they're a precursor, a necessary prerequisite to human life.
Absolutely. The microbes are over a billion years old, and they made life on Earth for everyone else possible. So they lived for quite a few years on Earth with no oxygen, and there are bacteria that can live without oxygen. And they also lived in the deep sea because the land was uninhabitable because of the UV rays from the sun. But the microbes evolved to produce oxygen using photosynthetic energy, using the sun as energy. And it was that process of evolution of oxygen that created the ozone layer. And the ozone layer filters out a lot of the UV light on Earth and makes life on the land parts of the Earth possible. So after the microbes did their job producing oxygen, it was possible for aerobic forms of life, those that depend on oxygen, to evolve and then also to evolve on land instead of just in the seas.
It sounds as if the development of life, at least in microbial form, is almost inevitable if you have some kind of hosts, some kind of planet-like structure, they will almost inevitably develop life.
The versatility of the microbes leads me to say, yes, that's probably true. And although we haven't found them alive on other planets, there are lines of evidence that suggest that they have been there or perhaps are still there. On planet Earth, there's no question that every nook and cranny and every different habitat in every organism of other types, there are microbes. And they have evolved since the time when they changed the face of the Earth by producing oxygen. They've continued to evolve and to diversify and acquire the ability to degrade new substrates, to produce new metabolites. And as the rest of life evolved, the microbes evolved as well. And so every animal form and plant form that has evolved has also evolved a community of microbes associated with it.
How far down do we find them in the earth, the crust and all of that? Do you have a sense of that?
That still isn't known. We know that you can find them thousands of feet or even miles down in Earth. They've tracked them in gold mines, which are very, very deep in South Africa, and in a number of other environments that are pretty deep and in some cases very hot, the microbes are there. Whether they go right to the core of the Earth, I think, is something for debate. We don't know that yet.
And how do you prove that you found a microbe? No, these are invisible. I mean, in other words, if you're looking for evidence, what is it that you see and how do you know it's alive?
Well, most of the time we start these days with DNA evidence. And so we extract the DNA from whatever the sample is. It may be a bucket of soil or seawater or a sample from the human gut. And after we extract the DNA, there are signature sequences in the DNA that indicate the kinds of organisms that are there. And often when we sample from these very exotic sites like miles down in the earth or the deep ocean or hot springs in Yellowstone, we find signature sequences that are very divergent from the bacteria that we typically are more familiar with. And so that's the first evidence that there are lineages of life in these environments that differ greatly from the standard lineages that we know about in more common environments that we study or those that we study with more common methods like culturing on petri dishes.
And how much smaller than the kinds of things that you would see in a high school biology microscope? How much smaller than that are you talking?
Well, many of these microbes can be seen with a standard microscope. So typically what we look at, for example, in high school would be a eukaryotic cell, so something that comes from a plant or an animal or perhaps a fungus. Those have large cells with nuclei. Microbes tend to be, for example, bacterial microbes tend to be about 1/50th the size of a larger eukaryotic cell. So smaller than most of the things you've probably seen in high school biology, but not invisible, certainly quite visible with high-powered optics.
Do we have broad categories of them as we would for anything else in the animal kingdom?
We do. We have a good taxonomy that separates the microbes into different groups. We have some of the same names for those groups, like kingdom and phylum are still useful words for the microbes. But the entire tree of life, including the microbes and plants and animals, has been reorganized because of what we now know about microbiology. By using these signature sequences in the DNA of organisms, we have rebranched that tree and discovered that the vast majority of organisms in the tree and most of the diversity space is made up of microbes. And the plants and the animals are just a teeny little tip of a branch.
I knew you were going to say that. We're this tiny minority compared to the vast number. It's a good thing they can't vote.
You also said that only a small number of these microbes are germs or disease-causing. So where do they fit in if you're sort of looking for categories?
So if we think about the functions rather than just who they're related to, the story is really quite amazing because there are thousands of species that are beneficial to the earth, either make life possible in a broader way by producing nutrients or getting rid of toxins or something like that. But then all plants and animals depend on the microbes in them and on them for life. And so only a tiny percentage, there are, I think, out of the many thousands of species we've defined, I think there are only about 80 that are truly pathogenic. And those have given microbes the bad name because they've been the most evident activity of microbes for most of human existence.
Such as?
All the diseases that are caused by bacteria and fungi and viruses in particular. Bacterial diseases that are well known are tuberculosis, strep throat. Ear infections are usually caused by bacteria. There are a variety of these very aggressive bacteria. I think staph infections have gotten a lot of press recently, and certainly many viral infections. We know about the swine flu and many other viral microbes. But what's interesting is that we're now beginning to find that the normal bacteria in our bodies play just as significant, probably an even more significant role in our health as those that cause disease. So, for example, when you imbalance the bacteria of the gut, you can induce obesity. And so there's now very clear evidence that obesity has a genetic component in the host, the person or animal, but it also won't develop without the right kinds of microbes. There's evidence that even behaviors can be affected by the gut bacteria. So people have found that if you grow mice without any gut microbes, they become much less aggressive, particularly the male mice. Apparently, they don't eat their babies as often if they don't have bacteria in them. So you can imagine the upcoming defense in court, the microbes made me do it.
Yeah, it's interesting why that would have a connection there between the microbes in your gut and that kind of behavior.
Well, are microbes for the most part parasitic? I mean, do they pretty much always have to have some kind of a host or some kind of a...
Most of them are not parasitic. It's interesting that we wouldn't survive very long without our microbes, but they could probably do just fine without us. And they probably did for a long time before we came along. So no, most of them are not parasitic. They can live in soil, in ocean water, in various environments where they're not living on or in another organism. But they do depend on each other. And the cycles of all the nutrients on Earth depend on microbes. So not every microorganism can carry on every chemical reaction. So they clearly depend on other microbes to complete those cycles.
You mentioned that microbes have a bad name because of all the ones that, you know, cause disease and so on. I think part of it, too, is that with invisible entities, you have this feeling that you're being invaded or occupied by things you can't even see. It's kind of spooky, right?
I think it is. When most people hear that the vast majority of cells in their body are microbial, they do feel like they've been occupied by some alien. But I think the more you know about them and the more you realize how dependent we are on them, you become almost protective of your bacteria. And you realize that you want to protect that environment, particularly the one in your gut, in order to remain healthy.
So how many do we have? How many different kinds of bacteria? What do they do for us?
Well, we probably have about 1,000, and that's a very rough estimate, 1,000 different species of bacteria. Most of them are living in the gut. We also have probably hundreds of species in our mouths. Across all people, there is enormous variation in what lives there. Any given person might not have hundreds of species in their mouth, but there is enormous variety. And then, of course, our skin has a great variety of organisms. So among these thousands, they carry on various functions. So one that's absolutely essential in the gut is they transduce the energy in our much of our food and turn it into a fatty acid or a number of fatty acids that we can then use for energy or to repair cells. They produce, E. coli, for example, produces vitamin K, which is important in blood clotting. So people who lose their normal microflora or microbes in their gut due to long-term antibiotic treatment actually have to take vitamin K supplements or they will eventually bleed to death. So those are just a couple of the examples, but recently things have emerged that indicate that HDL-LDL ratios in the blood are determined by bacteria in the gut. So I think we're going to find that there's a much wider range of activities that they're carrying out.
Are there any efforts to sort of implant bacteria?
Absolutely. That's becoming a very large part of medical research in terms of ways to mitigate the negative effects of microbes and to protect against certain kinds of conditions. And the first and probably most common is probiotics. Many people have seen them in the health food stores or in the drugstores. You can find these pills that contain live bacteria. The most common of those is Lactobacillus acidophilus, known as Acidophilus. There's not a lot of evidence suggesting that these organisms survive in the gut. In fact, most of the evidence says they don't. And yet, a number of them have been shown to have systemic activities. And so what they're doing, we really don't know. They're not going down there and colonizing and living on, but they're causing some sort of response, we think maybe an immunological one, that in some cases can reduce infection by bad microbes. In other cases, can reduce inflammation of the gut. There's some indication that there may be in the future probiotic approaches to treating even diseases like asthma, because there's a very tight link between the gut and the lungs. And so there's thought to be a microbial component of asthma. So that's one of the approaches that's being taken, is actually to eat the bacteria. Another is what we call prebiotics, which is eating certain kinds of foods or substances that will enhance the populations of the good bacteria and reduce populations of others. And then there are all sorts of ideas about literally, like you said, implanting them, placing them right in the site where we want them to grow. And there's been a little bit of that done, but it's not precise enough yet to be a standard treatment.
Well, we'll see if we can get some idea of what those foods are that you can eat to get bacteria that you need when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Joe Handelsman, and we're talking about the microbial planet. Norman was just mentioning food that you might take to have better health, to promote bacterial growth or to restore damaged bacteria. What comes to my mind immediately is yogurt.
Yogurt is a delivery system for live bacteria because there are Lactobacillus acidophilus, the same ones that are in most of the probiotic pills. So it's just an easy way of consuming bacteria. But there are also foods that seem to enhance certain groups of bacteria. And there was one study that I found particularly intriguing that was done by the Kirin Brewing Company in Japan. And they found that a substance called germinated barley foodstuffs, and I never quite found out what that was in American terms, but we think it's the green mash that you have during brewing. When they fed that to animals, they found that the frequency of colitis outbreaks in test animals that were induced for colitis was down, and they could extend the time between outbreaks. And so they wondered what this was doing, and they found that the animals had a shift in the microbes in their gut, that when they were eating the so-called germinated barley foodstuffs, it increased a particular group of bacteria. So the scientists thought, well, maybe we can just implant those bacteria right into the gut. And they found that, in fact, that worked, that also reduced the colitis. So then they wondered what the bacteria were doing. And they found that these bacteria produced one particular fatty acid, which is used by the wall of the gut for repair. So they thought, well, if we just put that fatty acid right into the gut, maybe we'd have the same effect. And it did. And so that's an example where we know the whole cascade of what happens from eating the food to getting the effect. We know right down to the chemical level what it's doing. There are other examples that aren't quite as clear, and we don't have as good evidence of what these substances are doing.
Is there ever an issue of – I start thinking in environmental terms here, you know, where you introduce a species, it's mm-hmm. beneficial, and then whoops, now we have too much of it and we need to bring in something else to – whittle it down. I mean, is that phenomenon occur in these situations?
It's not that common because we don't manipulate communities deliberately very often. What does happen is the most common example of that is when we treat with antibiotics, particularly over a long period of time, sometimes the community in the gut gets kind of out of kilter and an organism named C. diff takes over and causes a horrible illness. And one of the ways that they treat that, in fact, is with probiotics to give some of the competitors back to the system to keep C. diff under control. One of the problems today in microbiology is that we're learning about all of these connections between the communities and the structure of those communities and the health of the host. But we don't know very much about how to manipulate communities. And communities tend to be intrinsically robust and stable. And we just don't know what genes and what characteristics of organisms make them either able to invade those communities or make the communities resistant to invasion.
And how do microbes reproduce exactly? And I mean, what sort of makes them reproduce fast?
Usually it's having abundant food. And so when they're growing very rapidly, the cells simply split in two by a process called fission. It's the simplest kind of reproduction. But their genetic exchange doesn't depend just on that kind of reproduction. They have ways of exchanging genes that are separate from the reproductive process. And so they have this tremendous plasticity of their genomes, all of this exchange and change and variation that's generated by genes from different bacteria moving into different species.
But we're talking, again, about a whole range of organisms here, from, I assume, single-celled up to the size of the nematodes, which are a mm-hmm. relatively large number of cells.
Yeah, they tend to be 1,000 cells, and they're eukaryotic, so they have the big cells with nuclei. And so most people would probably say the microbes, when they think of microbes, are more typically bacteria and viruses and maybe some fungi.
But they're actually exchanging genetic material asexually, you're saying, all the way, or just the bacteria?
Bacteria in particular seem very effective at taking up DNA or genes from their environment or donating those genes to another organism. And so there is this process that we don't fully understand called horizontal gene transfer, and it's horizontal because it's between organisms, not from generation to generation.
I saw the term metagenomics used to describe work in your lab. Can you explain what that is?
My lab was struggling with the challenge of studying bacteria that can't be cultured in the lab. And since people have figured out about 20 years ago that, in fact, most bacteria can't be cultured in the lab, we were intrigued with how do we study those organisms. And we had a lot of information about the one signature sequence that indicates what the organism is related to. But that's just one gene among all the genes in the bacterium. Usually there are about 5,000 genes in a bacterium. And so we wanted to study them functionally. What are they doing, not just who are they related to? So we developed a method, and a number of labs developed this at the same time, where we simply extract the DNA from the sample. So we don't isolate the bacteria in culture. We just take a hunk of soil or seawater or whatever the sample might be, And we physically extract the DNA, break open the bacterial cells so they release their DNA. And then we cut the DNA up into small pieces and insert those pieces into E. coli or another surrogate host that can carry little fragments of DNA. And then we study those fragments in the bacterium like E. coli that will grow in culture. So it's called metagenomics because meta in Greek means transcendent. So it goes above the individual level and looks at the whole community as a single genome.
And how are you going to apply that?
Well, we've created clone banks of genes from a number of different environments, mostly from soil and some from the guts of insects, the bacterial communities in their guts. And our prime interest is in discovery of antibiotics and antibiotic resistance genes. And we found some new antibiotics this way. What we look for is an E. coli cell that has a piece of metagenomic DNA in it that has the capacity to produce an antibiotic where the normal E. coli doesn't. And so the genes that we've picked up from the soil organisms are now directing E. coli to create a new molecule, a new antibiotic.
And that then would be generated, I'll say, naturally because E. coli is such a common inhabitant of our guts anyway.
Well, we use that more as a technological tool to get E. coli to produce the antibiotic in the laboratory just as a way of expressing the genes that are inherent in all these organisms in the soil.
You mentioned insect guts. Why the guts of, you know, caterpillars or other insects? Why that environment?
We became interested in insects through some interactions between bacteria that we were studying in the gypsy moth, which is a voracious consumer of plant material across the eastern half of the United States.
No problem getting a hold of a few.
No, they're pretty easy to get a hold of. You can pick them off the trees at about this time or a little bit earlier.
I would think you could get grant funding to study gypsy moths, too, because they're known to be such a problem.
Yeah, they're a really awful problem. And we hope that in the long run, understanding their gut microbiology will lead to new ways to kill them. It's a particularly interesting environment because the caterpillars of – these are the caterpillar stage of the moths and butterflies – have extremely high pH guts. The pH of their guts can be as high as 12, which is pretty alkaline. We would not survive very long at that kind of pH.
Why is it so high in a caterpillar?
I don't know. No idea. But the caterpillar maintains that pH, and then the bacteria may contribute to maintaining the pH, but they certainly can survive at that pH. So we were interested in these bacteria living in what appears to be a pretty extreme environment, and they grow quite happily and survive in the gut. And some of them are even very closely related to the bacteria that live in our guts, which, of course, is not very high pH. So we found that to be an interesting parallel. And the more we looked at the caterpillar guts, the more they started looking like human guts. The structure of the wall of the gut is very similar. The bacterial community has a reasonably similar composition. And the basic functions are the same. And so we started studying the interactions of bacteria in the gut. One of the reasons that bacteria are particularly relevant to gypsy moths is that there's only one way to control the gypsy moth really effectively through most of the country, and that's the use of Bacillus thuringiensis, or we call it BT, which is a bacterium that produces a toxin that kills gypsy moths. And so in Madison, Wisconsin, you often hear little planes flying over in the spring and depositing this whitish-yellowish powder. And that's what they're depositing is BT bacteria, so that when the leaves of trees are coated with BT, when the caterpillars take a bite, the BT kills them. And so we were interested in how BT kills caterpillars and found that it looks like it's an interaction between BT and the normal gut bacteria.
And what possible other uses besides, you know, helping to figure out how to get rid of gypsy moths or something, what other uses could there be for studying the guts of caterpillars?
Because they're so similar in many ways to human guts and other animal guts, we think of it as a model system where we can manipulate it more easily than a human gut, but might be a good stand-in for the human gut. And one of the things we're most interested in is that it looks like the BT bacterium may mimic a disease of humans called sepsis, which is an infection of the blood. And there seem to be enormous parallels there. And so we're beginning to study the effect of BT on the various organs. So sepsis is characterized by organ failure. And so we're asking whether the insect's little tiny heart fails in the way a human does and all down the line. In fact, insects can even run fevers, which most people don't think they can. They're cold-blooded animals.
I'm just trying to picture this little tiny thermometer. Yeah. How do you measure
rubbing
that?
Rubbing the legs together? Or
very, very small. Actually, bees will warm themselves. They warm their wings before flying by kind of shrugging their shoulders. We don't know about the gypsy moths, but there are some insects that can run a fever by developing chemical heat energy.
How is it determined when spraying for gypsy moths then that this substance, this bacterial coating of the leaves, which kills the caterpillar, how is it determined that it doesn't harm anybody else?
BT has been used for over 50 years in the United States and around the world. And before it was implemented in the field, it was tested in a very rigorous set of tests on mammals and birds and plants to determine that it didn't have effects. It does affect other caterpillars that are in the moth and butterfly family, but it won't affect insects outside that family unless you use a different BT that targets that group. And it doesn't seem to affect in any significant way other higher animals.
But does that mean no gypsy moths, no butterflies?
The spraying tends to be on the leaves of trees at a time when the butterflies aren't actually out.
And or so haven't come up yet, maybe, from south.
Right. I mean, it depends on the species. But because it's so early in the year, we're dealing more with trees that are in leaf. And so the gypsy moths will eat those leaves and die. Most butterflies, well, butterflies can't eat leaves, right? They drink nectar. And by the time the flowers are present, typically the BT is gone. But that is a concern that people have been looking at. And so far, there isn't evidence that spraying BT has very large effects on the ecology of forests. But it certainly has some, no question about it.
I'm trying to picture what it is you do when you actually go into the lab, what sort of equipment you're using, you know, in order to study the guts of caterpillar, what kind of building and equipment and facilities do you have to have?
Well, we work in the Microbial Sciences Building in Madison, and it's a building filled with microbiologists, which most people find kind of surprising that there are over 40 labs doing different kinds of research on microbes, probably one of the highest concentrations of microbiologists in the world. And our lab has all the standard equipment for dissecting insects, for rearing insects, and then for growing bacteria, but more importantly, working with the genes of bacteria, isolating the DNA and being able to manipulate that DNA.
What kind of machines does that take?
In general, manipulating the DNA takes not very high-tech machines or equipment. We tend to use chemical means for extracting the DNA and then typically centrifuges to separate the junk from the material we want, electrophoresis, which moves DNA in an electric field, and a lot of water baths carry out chemical reactions on the DNA.
And can you actually see microbes at some point and, I mean, get some sort of picture?
Yeah, those image? Are the that's the expensive equipment is the microscopy to be able to see the microbes. And so the imaging capacity at this university is particularly good. And that's the expensive equipment that we use to see the microbes. And, of course, that to a microbiologist is one of the most exciting parts is actually seeing them in their home inside the insect or on a soil particle.
Do they tend to evolve more quickly than larger organisms?
Well, they evolve more quickly in the human time because they have so many more generations than we do in the same amount of time.
More on the microbial planet when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is Jo Handelsman, and she is an expert in microbial life forms, which are, as it turns out, very crucial to us, many of them. Far more of them are beneficial than are harmful to humans. Is there any way that humans in their lifestyle can actually impair the work of these microbial allies?
We can certainly change their communities. There was a very interesting study on mice recently where they wanted to ask, does our diet affect our microbes? And the assumption was that it did. But they took a very radical approach, and they fed one group of mice typical mouse chow, which is very high in carbohydrates and not a lot of fat. And the others, they fed Big Macs and sugar. And what was the big surprise was, yes, the communities of microbes in the guts of these mice changed. But what was the surprise was how quickly. It happened within a couple of days. They could begin to see the change in the composition of the community. So there's no question that what we do to our bodies affects our microbes. But we don't quite know enough yet to be able to say which changes are good and which aren't and what foods will enhance the good ones. I think that's one of the big areas for the future of this field called personalized medicine is beginning to look at the profile of an individual's microbial community and think about how to enhance the beneficial ones or, if someone has high cholesterol, changing the microbiology of the gut so that their cholesterol goes down, things like that. And I think when personalized medicine starts taking the microbes into account, it will move a lot faster.
Is it possible to be too clean?
Oh, absolutely. We need our microbes, and we certainly know that we get many of them from our environment. There's one theory that maybe children eat earth, because apparently it's very common in many societies, including ours, that young children will eat soil. And there's one theory that maybe eating soil inoculates the body with certain microbes. Now, as far as I know, there's no evidence to support that, but it is an idea.
I think you hear about pregnant women occasionally getting that. Is it called pica? Is that the same thing?
I don't know.
You have this urge to eat dirt.
Oh, is that right?
It's
not dirt. It's soil.
Soil.
Yeah, that's right.
I've also seen the reference to the hygiene hypothesis about asthma, too, that we're having too much of a protection from the environment can actually create more of a problem. Mm-hmm. I suppose that goes along with what you're saying.
For allergies, too. Yes, we've heard that.
Makes you wonder, too, when you wash your hands in a typical, hand-washing thing, how much you're actually affecting those microbes that are on your hands.
Well, usually you can wash off the ones that you've acquired from elsewhere, so it's a really good idea to wash hands so that you're not accumulating other people's germs. But your good bacteria that live on your hands, some of them will be washed off, but they'll grow back very quickly. So it's very hard to get rid of the entire microbial community on hands or any surface of the body.
Now, you mentioned earlier, Joe, microbes. We've talked about the gut as being one of their favorite locations, but also you mentioned the skin and the mouth. Now, are these beneficial? And if so, how?
The bacteria living on the skin, the mouth, in the nose, and the vagina are very important for protecting against disease. So in general, they seem to act as a barrier to pathogens. And when the balance of the bacteria that are normally there is upset, then the community becomes more vulnerable to invaders. So in the mouth, the healthy mouth will have fewer of the bacteria that produce the acid that decays teeth, for example.
What about the process of microbes growing on food that you've left in the refrigerator too long?
Microbes will grow on any good food source, and our food sources do seem to be preferred by many of them. I think food microbiology is one of the very underappreciated fields in the 20th and 21st century because our food has been so safe for so long that it's not the kind of pressing, urgent issue that it was maybe 100 or more years ago before we had refrigeration and pasteurization and some of the processes that make food cleaner and freer of pathogens. So it's a pretty good idea not to eat food that's been visibly invaded by bacteria. There are always going to be bacteria and fungi present, but when you can start seeing the visible effects, they may be producing toxins or other compounds that are toxic to us.
So is that true of, you hear people say, well, that's just penicillin on that cheese. It's good for you. Not true?
The penicillium mold that's used in certain cheeses that have a blue color is a good penicillium. And the penicillium mold that's used to produce the antibiotic penicillin is probably one of the most important microbes on Earth. In the 1940s, it was developed to produce enough penicillin that the penicillin was shipped over to Europe. And World War II, as a result, was the first war in American history, probably in history generally, where people died directly of the effects of bombs and bullets rather than of the infections resulting. So penicillin really transformed human existence. And so penicillium mold is a pretty important and positive part of human existence. But there are also strains of the penicillium mold that produce some very mild carcinogens and some other compounds that we probably don't want to be consuming. So if your bread has penicillium mold on it, you don't know if it's the good guy or the bad guy. It's probably better not to eat it.
Kind of like picking mushrooms, isn't it?
I would think there are a lot of different disciplines that kind of converge when you're talking about microbes because, well, you've got biochemistry and plant pathology in your own appointments, but then there must be also things like geology or areas of immunology. What kind of, you know, meeting of different kinds of scientists do you find around the topic of microbes?
Well, one of the reasons that Wisconsin is such an exciting place to be a microbiologist is that there are microbiologists not only in the departments that have micro in their name, but in departments like geology and chemistry and many other places on campus where microbes play a role. And it's that diversity of microbiologists that makes it so exciting because, of course, the diversity of microbes is one of their appeals.
And what are some of the directions in research that you're watching with excitement? In other words, when you go to a conference and there's sort of cutting-edge reports of something happening in labs here in Wisconsin or around the world, what are you most excited to watch?
There are a number of areas that are pretty urgent in human existence, and the microbes are probably going to be at least a partial solution to some of those problems. One is infectious disease and the isolation of new antibiotics and new ways of treating infectious disease with new kinds of vaccines or by manipulating the immune system, I think are going to be pretty critical to our future because the bacteria are once again getting the better of us. And before the age of antibiotics, most of the top 10 killers were bacteria. And then they slowly fell off that list because most of them became treatable with antibiotics. And they're rapidly moving back up in their power because we have such a rampant problem with antibiotic resistance in so many of the very bad pathogens. So I think the clever solutions and the really innovative new ideas in controlling infectious disease is going to be one of the very big thrusts of the future, an exciting field to watch. Another area that is pretty urgent in our lives is energy use, and the production of biofuels is dependent upon microbes. So microbes are the ones that will translate the, in most cases, plant material into energy that we can use to run a car or a house. So I think that's going to be a very interesting field to watch, and I think there are going to be a lot of new approaches to degrading or breaking down plant matter in ways that releases energy that we can capture and use. Another field that is sort of at a global level is looking at the impact of microbes on very, very large scales. So looking at their effect on the behavior of the oceans, the effect on global warming. So microbes have a very significant impact on carbon dioxide concentrations in the air, which, of course, are very important for global warming. They're the prime producers of methane, which is another greenhouse gas that affects global warming. And so I think looking at some of these large-level atmospheric problems from a microbial perspective will be one of the thrusts that's going to be very exciting in the future.
Microbes are used, aren't they, to clean up oil spills to some extent?
Yeah, microbes are used to fix a lot of problems, remediate a lot of problems that humans create. So one is the oil spill degrading bacteria, and they're very effective at that. They eat the oil and create other products that aren't as toxic to the oceans as oil. There's also a use of microbes that we don't actually intervene with, but just happens naturally, and that's the degradation of gasoline in the soil. And so old gasoline tanks are just buried all over the country. There are thousands of them all over the country. And many of them have gasoline or had gasoline remaining. And as they rust, the gasoline leaks into the earth and would be in our groundwater. We would all be drinking gasoline if it weren't for the bacteria that degrade it in the soil before it gets to the groundwater.
And I think it's also a key to, as you mentioned, breaking down some of these plant fibers for, say, either wood-based or corn-based ethanol. I think the trick is to break down that shell and get the energy out, and that's left up to microbes.
Right. That's one of the challenges, is taking these very large and stable and resistant polymers or fibers of plants and chopping them up into pieces. And that's the first step in creating biofuels, and really challenging. And it will be the microbes that find a way to do it.
But I gather there are some, from what you said early on, Joe, there are some artificial substances that even microbes can't break down.
There certainly are some, and that's probably a really good thing, or a lot of the structures around us would be crumbling.
There goes the Empire State Building.
Is there a sinister side of microbe study, too, in the sense that, you know, you could become Dr. Germ and figure out how to, you know, germ warfare, germ terrorism, and so on? In other words, knowing about microbes, can it, in a sense, give you power that could be used for negative purposes?
Well, of course, that's one of the concerns of the Defense Department, and it has substantial research on biodefense. And, of course, that's not to create bioweapons, but defend us against other countries' use of them. My own feeling is that the naturally occurring microbes that are bad are so bad, and they've evolved to be bad over such a long period of time, that they're probably more insidious than anything we could dream up in the laboratory. There are certainly ways of making them harder to treat by introducing antibiotic resistances or picking particularly bad strains. But the naturally occurring toxins and pathogenic elements of bacteria are pretty awful. And you just have to look at the history of plagues and disease epidemics on Earth to know that. So my own sense is that you don't have to know a whole lot about microbes to cause big problems with them. And so I worry less about the experts than about the people who just want to do evil.
Are there microbes that we can look back, you know, in the fossil record and say that really hasn't changed in the last 50 million years? Are they, I mean, some of them so successful in their most basic design that they don't need to change?
We know that some of the microbes have entered into relationships with their hosts a very, very long time ago, and there's a very beautiful symbiosis between bacteria and fungi and ants that evolved 50 million years ago, and they seem to have evolved since then together. But the bacteria haven't really changed that much. We can trace them right back to their relatives that didn't enter into those symbioses in the ants.
Endangered species of microbes?
I'm sure there are.
Don't step on that.
Every time we lose an acre of forest land, particularly tropical forests, people talk about all the macro species, the plants and animals that are going extinct. And with those, there are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of bacterial species that are also going extinct, if for no other reason, because almost every species that's been looked at has some bacterium in it that is hard to find elsewhere.
So if there were a code of conduct for you or for Emily or for me in terms of a healthy relationship with the microbes in our environment, what would it be? I mean, is there anything we need to change in our lifestyle to make sure that we continue to thrive in this symbiotic relationship?
Well, the main thing is just be good to your microbes and think about them a lot.
I can't see them.
Know that they're there and be grateful for them. But the other thing I think we can do that's very practical is to stop using the hand washers that have these antibacterial compounds in them, because some of those may actually select for antibiotic resistance as well as resistance to what's in the hand wash.
Are you talking about the ones that are in the hospital that are in every room just about for cleaning your sanitizer? sanitizing your hands?
The ones in the hospitals are pretty necessary, I think, to reduce the frequency of spread of bacterial infections among patients, which is one of the most serious problems in infectious disease, is the movement in hospitals. But a lot of people use these ones at home, these cleaners, that I think are less effective, and probably the most effective way of getting bacteria off your hands is just to wash vigorously with hot water and soap. And these commercial hand washers will probably do more damage than good in the long run.
You mean because they're actually making the bacteria evolve in such a way that they're even more resistant to washing?
They may be. What's really scary is they may be making bacterial communities that are more resistant to antibiotics. And so there's a little bit of evidence saying that when bacteria are selected, so when the ones survive that can grow around these hand wash compounds, they also have some resistance to antibiotics. And so it's not actually the resistance to the whatever's in the hand wash, it's the resistance to drugs that we might need someday to treat an infection.
So we can be too clean for our own good.
Yes.
So we should let children roll in the dirt, or excuse me, soil?
Certainly soil is not a source of particularly bad microbes. And I don't think we know enough yet to know if we really depend on it as a source of our microbes. It certainly is a source of our food. Indirectly, most of our food comes from the soil. And the microbes in that soil are absolutely critical to its productivity.
And those pets, household pets, a good source of sort of bonding with microbes that could be key to making you stronger?
You probably don't want to know about the exchange of microbes between your pets and you.
Do not kiss the dog. Do not kiss the horse. I know that much. But
there's apparently a very powerful similarity between the profile of microbes in household animals and in their owners. There's evidence that pig farmers have great similarities among their gut microbes and their pigs' gut microbes.
Wow. So that implies that there is quite an exchange of some
somehow
sort going on.
Yep. That's one of the reasons we worry about using antibiotics as heavily as we do in animal husbandry, because there is evidence that the bacteria will move from the animal's guts to us. And if they've been selected for resistance, then we're acquiring antibiotic resistance from them.
So despite that sort of yuck factor, you still are a champion of microbes.
Absolutely. Most of them are really, really good, and we wouldn't survive without them.
Jo Handelsman, it has been a pleasure to romp through the field of microbes with you.
Well, thank you. I hope you're feeling better about your microbes now.
I felt pretty good in the first place, but even better now. Thanks for being with us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.